Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the show. It's Risky Business episode 57 now, proof that time flies. This edition of Risky Business is brought to you by McAfee, makers of fine computer security software since 1852. Well, maybe not since then, but big thanks to McAfee for paying our bills this week anyway. On today's show, we'll be having a look at an unusual topic. We've all heard of search engine optimization, or SEO, the practice of trying to boost your company's website in search engine rankings for certain keywords, but what about the opposite? Anti-SEO is a burgeoning field, and one New Zealand-based researcher Roberto Sugi-Liverani says is a growing problem. He'll be along soon to enlighten us. We'll also be joined by Nishad Harath, a senior researcher with McAfee, in this week's sponsor interview. We're talking about computer users. You know, those mouth-breathing meatbags who sit in front of those beautiful computers you secure, running malware on them because they think they're loading up a dancing bear's screensaver that their friend just sent them, when in fact it's the latest rootkit. Ugh. Well, anyway, we're talking to Nishad about how to keep them happy, that's the users, and behaving well in your organisation, and as you'll hear, that's not always easy. Sort of a combination of the iron fist and the velvet glove. But first, as always, it's time for a check of this week's news with ZDNet Australia's editor, Munir Kataria. Munir, in our first news item, it seems that Hezbollah...
say that without laughing.
No, I can't. Hezbollah isn't just getting its kicks out of throwing rockets into Israel. It seems it's embarked on this coordinated attack to threaten a Melbourne woman.
Apparently so, and all because she refused his friend request on Facebook.
Now,
so,
we should probably explain to the listeners what's really going on here.
This is an AAP story that we just put up, actually, and apparently a Melbourne-based woman got a friend request from some guy. This man, he's calling himself Ibrahim Dirani, and, you know, he put a friend request in to this woman from Melbourne, and she turned it down, and the next thing, he sends her a message saying, "I am Hezbollah, I'm going to kill you and your family, promise you."
Yeah, now what I think is funny about this, that's not funny, right? The woman's obviously spooked.
I reckon,
had her family threatened and whatever. What I think is funny is that AAP are prepared to present this as a case of Hezbollah actually threatening someone. It's obviously some sort of crazy, just trying to wind her up.
I reckon it is. It just seems really daft. And if it's not, then, you know, all those friend requests you get on Facebook, I'd be really, really scared to turn any down from now onwards.
But there you go. The reason we include it, yet another security risk. From Facebook and social networking sites. If you use Facebook, careful who you say no to, because Hezbollah is going to come and get you. Now, this next bit of news concerns Checkpoint, and I should actually point out, just as a disclaimer, that they are a sponsor of this podcast.
Well, this is a new one. They're launching it. It's their Zone Alarm Force Field security product.
Now, it looks like it's a... basically, what it is some sort of sandboxing virtualization thing for a browser. So you load it up. Even if your browser gets pwned, not such a big deal. That's the idea anyway.
I mean, you know, talk about a useful product that we all definitely need at the moment. This is something which, you know, it seems like it's got a lot of potential there.
Yeah, well, it is interesting to see a major vendor putting something like this out as a beta and encouraging people to download it. But it is a free beta, isn't it?
As far as I know, yes, it is. I remember them talking about this late last year, back in 2007. And so, yeah, it's about time that they launched it. They have been chatting about it for quite a while. At the time, I remember they did a bit of a demo as well. You know, they'd built their own little keylogger and they put it in just to show how it didn't work. But, I mean, you know, it seems like a really good idea. You know, how often have we spoken about these iframe attacks and the applications and being owned that way? If only you had a safe environment to surf from.
Yeah. Well, it looks like they're going to plug this into their, their Zone Alarm product, and it's called Force Field. So interested people should go forth and Google to see if they are interested in installing that and having a bit of a go. If it turns out to be an interesting bit of software, by all means, email me. Let me know. patrick@dotbob.net, dotbob.net.
One thing about that, I would be interested to know what kind of restrictions it means. I mean, just if you've got a sandbox browser and stuff, does that mean that if you want sites to remember you, that they can't either? You know, I mean, does it mean that there's no more cookies, there's no more remembering of passwords and that kind of thing? That I'd be really interested to find out.
Well, that's a different aspect to the product, which is that it actually does, you know, anonymizes you to an extent. I love the headline that you guys gave that story, by the way, which was for listeners out there who didn't see it. It's Checkpoint makes it safe to surf for porn.
Oh, but do you know what? That is what they're selling it as, even if they say actually. I think their actual pitch is, it's great if you want to buy a gift for a loved one, but you don't want them to trace your history.
So basically it's a way to look at boobies without your girlfriend finding out.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, right. But, you know, it doesn't, like, do anything to obfuscate content or, you know, encrypt content. So, you know, I wouldn't try loading it up. If you're listening and you're not really a security professional, you don't quite understand the issues, I wouldn't recommend you install this and think that your admins can't see you looking at pictures. Because, anyway, okay, moving on. From Security Focus comes this next piece. Apparently cybercrime is inflicting more and more losses on the economies of the planet.
Yeah, they are, yeah. They released a report on Thursday and say online fraud grew, $239 million in 2007.
Up from $198 million.
Yeah. I just thought it'd be a lot more.
Yeah, but this has come from the FBI, not a security vendor, right? Which is why it sounds reasonable. If it was, you know, a security vendor, they'd say cybercrime is
billion.
Yeah, cybercrime is costing us
$50 billion.
But how many years ago did we hear that, you know, cybercrime now is worth more than drugs?
Oh, but that was widely dismissed as bullshit, you know? I mean, no one bought that.
Okay.
Well, except okay. Maybe some overzealous journalists, maybe. But that was I think, that was widely sort of panned, that figure. Some people sort of sat down with some calculators and worked it out and said, no.
Okay. So we think this is a more realistic figure. There'll be 240-odd million.
Well, that's I'd imagine, given that it's an FBI survey, that would be within the borders of the United States. But I think, I don't know. I don't know that it's a conservative estimate, I guess. I don't know. Metrics in security are always tough.
Yeah,
we all know that, you know. God, try convincing
it. So it's somewhere between 239 million and
50 billion. Okay, we'll just leave it at that, will we? All right. Now, in this next item, Andrew Donahue from ZDNet UK writes that dumb users are not necessarily to blame for data loss incidents.
And this is something we've heard about for so long. It's always the dumb users that do it, right? But
stupid
apparently
humans.
It's not true.
No. Look, I mean, what's being argued, and this is more of a feature-style article, but what's being argued here by Debbie Ashenden, who's a senior researcher at the Defence College of Management and Technology at Cranfield University, is that really it's a matter of training and process. You need to ingrain a culture of information security and data security into an organisation in order to keep that data safe, and not just kick someone in the head if they happen to leave a backup disk somewhere. You know, I mean, what were they doing with that backup disk in the first place? Where was
and
the process?
And why wasn't that backup disk encrypted?
Exactly. You know, so I think what they were trying to make, you know, I think the point they're trying to make here is that it's all well and good to sort of point at someone and go, you're an idiot, you did this, you did that, but really, without broader problems in an organization, that's not likely to happen.
What we're basically going down is to have proper security policies, stick to them, and make sure the users are educated. It's all simple rules, really.
Yeah, I mean, it is the same stuff that we've heard over and over, but I guess it's just interesting hearing it put like that, especially coming from a UK reporter and a UK
Definitely.
Academic after that whole tax office snafu.
That's right. They've been having a few issues over there.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the US military has stepped up the arms race in cyber warfare terms. Munir, can you walk us through this next piece?
That's right. This is a story we wrote last week. US Air Force Cyber Command, basically, they're going to use network warfare. So they're going to attack enemies with denial of service attacks and basically delete all their data.
Well, it's stage one of a physical attack to soften an enemy's defenses. So really, you know, knocking out, I'd imagine they'd want to knock out utilities, communications, media, stuff like that for 24 hours, then go bomb them flat. It's what Americans do best. So, yeah, the Air Force Cyber Command is a US military unit set up in September 2007 to fight in cyberspace. But really, this is an escalation. This is the equivalent of China shooting down a satellite and the US jumping up and down going, you're escalating an arms war.
What I'm worried about is the collateral damage here. Can you imagine the kind of systems they're going to use? And they're going to launch this attack and it's going to go straight through the web and it's going to knock things out all over the place.
Well, first thing they're going to need to do is, you know, I bet you right now what they're developing, they're sitting on a pile of zero days and they're modeling a worm that they can send off into China, which is only going to infect Chinese IPs. I mean, obviously some on funny IPs might get infected outside of there or whatever. They can only infect Chinese PCs and just create havoc within that network. And I imagine that that is very much what they're working on at the moment, to create havoc. And it makes sense, really, from a military point of view.
It does make a lot of sense. I'm surprised we haven't heard about it before. It's nice to see that they're actually admitting that they're working on it, which is a good thing. Mm. But it's very, very scary. I remember writing about this about, I don't know, 4 years ago. There was a company called Symbiot. And they, it was actually just before the 1st of April in 2004 when they're Texas-based, who would have thought, but they launched their first products and they were designed so that enterprises could actually hit back at people who were striking DDoS attacks against them. And at the time, there was massive outrage and everyone was saying, you guys are crazy, and all these collateral damage arguments came out as well. I can't say I've seen them do too much since then, but maybe they flogged all their kit to the US military.
Well, you know, when we say collateral damage, we should point out that data packets, even containing 0 days, don't actually explode.
They don't.
No. And they don't kill people. So, you know.
We're talking collateral IT damage.
Maybe this is the sort of arms race we need, you know?
I guess so. Yeah, it'd be a lot better than the kind we have at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we should, instead of pitting our armies and our bombs and all that sort of shit against each other, we can just have a nerd off. It's like our nerds versus your nerds.
I'm quite worried. Isn't that how they got the nuclear bomb in the first place?
Oh, you make a very good point, Mia. You make a very good point. Touche, sir. Touche. Okay, Moon, that's going to wrap it up for this week. Thank you very much for a livelier than usual news session.
Cheers, mate. It was a pleasure.
Munir Katadia, ZDNet Australia's editor there with this week's headlines. You can read all of those stories at zdnet.com.au. Well, except for the one that we got from Security Focus. Anyway, it's time for this week's feature interview now. Are you having some problems with a competitor? Does a search on Google for your products or services show up their website first? In circumstances like these, you used to have one option. You could consult a search engine optimization expert. By using search engine optimization, or SEO, you can boost your rankings in search engines, hence the name. All makes sense, right? But these days you have a second option. You can engage in anti-SEO on their website. Risky Business spoke to Roberto Sugi-Liverani from securityassessment.com in New Zealand about anti-SEO. You'll hear him say CEO, but I'm fairly confident he means SEO, as in search engine optimization. Accent differences aside, Roberto has been researching the techniques used by bad guys to damage the search engine rankings of their competitors, and he says the behavior is on the rise. He started off by describing exactly what anti-SEO is.
Yes, we can also refer as a negative SEO, and when we talk about that term, we actually talk about all different techniques that can be used to sabotage a website ranking in the search engine results. And when I say sabotage, I mean we can decrease the page rank of the site, or even worse, we can make the target site disappear from the search engine results.
So it's really about, instead of trying to optimize someone's ranking, you're really trying to do the opposite. And
the opposite, yeah.
Remove them from Google, basically.
Yep.
Well, I mean, you don't even have to remove someone, do you? Because once you drop them off the first top, you know, couple of pages, then no one's really going to find them, are they?
In fact, we can decrease the page rank, so instead of appearing on the first page for specific keywords, they can appear on the second, third page, or we can make it disappear. It really depends from the scope of the attacker.
Now, I imagine this is the sort of thing that companies would do to their competitors in order to boost their own relative Google rank, you know, knock out the competition and then just eventually rise to the top that way. But is this sort of dark SEO, is it legal? That's the thing, because you're not, I imagine you don't really have to hack into any systems to do this. You're just trying to trick crawlers.
Yes and no, because according to what I'm doing as a research, I'm finding out that you can also use web application vulnerabilities to leverage these kind of attacks. So it depends how the competition is involved with hacking websites. And for instance, you can use like cross-site scripting vulnerability to leverage some kind of attacks and get your target site to be decreased or penalized. So
let me guess, you'd set up a site with some really bad spam content on it, and then use a cross-site scripting vulnerability in your target to display that bad content on the good site. Is that right?
Yes, that's one.
So someone would be going to, like, and instead they'd be seeing, you know, free naked pictures.
You can do that, yes. And that's just one way you can exploit a web application vulnerability to actually leverage that kind of attack. So we are talking about injecting spam links into the target site through a cross-site scripting. And because there are different kind of cross-site scripting, you can achieve different results. If we are talking about a permanent cross-site scripting, then you can permanently store data into the target. If we talk about a blog and then we have comments, the contents of the comments will be staying on the site permanently.
Okay, I see what you mean. So you put in, Viagra, Cialis, free midget porn.
Yeah, you can. If the target site is vulnerable to permanent cross-site scripting, then you can have permanent spam links in your target site.
Now, Roberto, what about things that you can do to reduce someone's page rank without actually having to manipulate code on their site? And you know, what are some legal ways you can do this? Can you just set up some bad spam sites and link them to your target? Will that actually affect their page rank?
Yeah, that is one way you can do that, and there are also other ways. Without hacking the target site, there are different attacks. For instance, the attacker might consider to use social bookmarks like dig.com, reddit.com, onlywire.com, and can actually simulate like persons with multiple accounts using the same IP address and spamming the URL of the target site. So it's like making appear like the target site is trying to self-promote itself.
So really what they're trying to do there is imitate the behavior of people who are doing noisy, bad SEO that's sort of recognized by Google as being spam.
So if dig.com, for instance, realized that target site is spamming, then the domain name can be banned on the dig.com. And if the domain name is banned on dig.com, it's actually decreasing the quality of the neighbor of the target site, because now search engines, they actually work under a logic of trust, and the neighbors, all the links, incoming links and outgoing links, has to be of good quality sites. And dig.com, all the big social bookmarks networks sites are really good websites to have links from. And if you are banned from those, then your page rank is going to decrease as well.
Now, in a strange way, this is almost like a form of defamation, but instead of trying to damage the reputation of your target in terms of the way people perceive it, you're trying to damage it in the way machines perceive it. Do you think that's a reasonable way of describing these sorts of attacks?
Yes, because you want the target site to disappear from its keywords, because the target site might use some specific keywords to appear in the search engine. If the competition is interested to take their place, they will do everything to actually make the target site to disappear or to be in another page, on the second, third page, so that people cannot find that site. And they will do everything. Yes, they can actually affect the reputation, or they might use these kind of techniques, which are understood by the search engine, to actually decrease the page rank of the target site.
So what sort of industries, what sort of companies are actually engaging in this sort of nasty behavior? Is it reserved for gray market companies like online casinos and pornography websites, that sort of thing?
There are companies which actually they perform SEO services. And there are also companies which are known to perform negative SEO. And at the beginning, if I remember well, they were hired because on certain blogs, especially political blogs, there were some comments, and the person who was managing that blog didn't want that comments to appear first. So they were actually hiring these companies to make those comments to appear on different pages on the search engines, so the people, they could not read those comments. So that was the first example of negative SEO.
So hang on, this was the politicians hiring people or the bloggers?
It's political blogs. So if you have a political blog and you have like people from the other parties complaining about your politics or whatever, they, in this case, these companies, these CEO companies, they were hired to actually hide the bad comments about the blog and to actually disappear from the search engine results.
Mm.
And that was the first instance where negative CEOs were used by so, by these companies. And of course, it'll always be used in the underground as well.
Yeah, now it is interesting. I did see a presentation in at KiwiCon from it was a colleague of yours, was it?
Yes, yeah, a friend of mine, Francois Gaspard.
He was really talking about the way Hezbollah has used these sorts of techniques to manipulate rankings to really push their propaganda. But you say that this is actually happening in the corporate sphere now as well. You say it originally started with political bloggers, and it's, you know, we've heard other reports that it's been used in the Israel-Lebanon conflict. So it seems quite a political bent. But, you know, have you heard of reputable companies actually using these techniques?
There have been cases where, yes, it was also a competition scenario. And just recently, I remember what they've done with the Donald Trump website. So if someone was looking for Donald Trump and they were using the Trump keyword...
Trump, you mean? Or?
Yeah. He was appearing the first one, but they actually hacked the meta keyword with spam words. So it was appearing as the first one, but then under the description of the site, there were all spam keywords instead of the description of his site.
So was that just a prankster?
Yeah.
But do you think this is going to become a legitimate tool that... Well, not a legitimate tool, but do you think this is going to become a standard tool in, you know, an online marketeer's toolkit? Do you think they're going to start launching negative SEO campaigns against their competition? And do you think the broader SEO community, do you think we're going to see open shop fronts offering these sorts of services to legitimate businesses?
That is very difficult to say because, anyway, we are still talking about illegal techniques and they cannot be sold directly or just the front. What I mean is that there will always be these kind of services, but they will be provided not directly to the companies, because that involves to actually bypass the webmaster or the Google webmaster guidelines,
yeah,
or the guidelines which are promoted by all the search.
But Google webmaster guidelines are not in fact law. So, I mean, I don't know that these techniques are per se illegal. They'd probably violate some.
They violate most of the guidelines.
Well, of the guidelines, yes, but, you know, as I said, the guidelines aren't law, so the worst that's going to happen is they'll get a spanking from Google.
Yeah.
So, okay, but you still don't see a time when this is going to become a publicly offered service?
I don't think so. It might become, but not public. It will still be something which is not offered directly to the companies.
Now, from a security point of view, this is a particularly interesting attack because you're looking at something that is designed to harm your business.
Yes.
Through the manipulation of computer systems which you have no control over. Is that a fair way of describing it?
Yeah, because before we're talking about how a cross-site scripting or SQL injection can be used to actually leverage these attacks. And in this case, there is a security component, but...
But, I mean, say you've sanitized your user input, you know, there's no cross-site scripting bugs and no SQL injection bugs on your site. People can still target you, can't they?
Sure, yeah. And what the recommendation from that against that kind of attacks then is to actually always follow what's happening on your site and look for your results. And like I was suggesting to you, you can use the Google Webmaster Tool or the Yahoo Site Explorer, which are tools which are actually the way to communicate with search engines and see what's happening to your site. And if there is something wrong, you can communicate through that tool to the search engines, or even the opposite, Google or Yahoo, they might come to you and say, look, there is something wrong, someone is spamming, blah, blah, blah. But yes, these attacks are still there, and they work, basically. So it's up to the webmaster to be really careful and actually follow what's happening for his keywords on the search engine.
So they really need to use those Google Webmaster tools to make sure that nothing's actually...
Well, that is a very useful tool you can actually use to understand if something is wrong, if you have bad links or if you have some complaint from Google, if someone was actually reporting you as a spammer, then you will get those kind of notifications through that tool, which anyways is better than nothing.
And then what, you contact Google and say, hey, these guys are trying to do a number on us?
Oh, you can do that, yeah, as well. Or you can also even re-ask resubmission for your site if it's been banned before. So they are trying to actually help webmaster because, yes, these attacks can be launched and they work. That's why you have Site Explorer or Google Webmaster tools there.
Is Google responsive when people complain about this sort of stuff?
Yeah, I found out that most of the forums and threads, yes, they tend to respond, but sometimes you have very frustrated companies and people, they actually didn't get any response, and they actually lost a lot of revenue from their site.
Mm.
So again, it really depends from the situation. And
now, you mentioned earlier that some legitimate businesses had been affected by these sorts of attacks. What sort of businesses are we talking about there?
Oh, we talk business which they do a lot of profit from just positioning on the search engines. I remember there was an article on the Forbes website, and they were talking about a diamond business, online business, and he was doing a lot of money by just people searching for buy diamonds online. And this website was attacked, and it was connected to different spam sites, and then it basically was banned by Google. And he lost a lot of money because of that, because people, they couldn't find any more that site as a first one for that keyword on the search engine results.
Okay. Look, I think that's going to wrap it up, Roberto. Thank you very much for taking time out to speak to Risky Business.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure, man.
Roberto Sughi-Liverani there from securityassessment.com. It's time now for this week's sponsor interview. Nishad Harath is a senior security researcher with McAfee, this week's Risky Business sponsor. Now, some in the IT security sphere seem eager to pin data loss incidents and hacks on incompetent staff rather than their own departments. And as tempting as it is to pass the buck, we know blaming users is getting a little bit old now. Making systems a little bit idiot-proof goes with the job of being a security manager or a CSO. So I asked Nishad if it's in fact the technology, security processes and their implementations that are to blame for users making bad decisions, not just plain old stupidity.
Well, I think it's a twofold problem. I mean, you can't just either blame it on the users or just blame it on the policy and the technology that's built in there to be able to support a policy. I think the problem needs to be looked at from both ends. Blaming one component of the greater security puzzle is not really going to get us anywhere.
Do you think we in the security industry have a tendency to be overly critical of users and, you know, sort of treat them as these dumb, lumbering idiots, when really it's our job to ensure that, you know, that we make systems more or less idiot-proof?
Well, it's a really hard problem because, I mean, you can't reasonably say that you can make a system 100% idiot-proof, and by the same token, I don't think that you should be treating your users as idiots or criminals in the first place. So I think you should focus on the fact that the users need to be educated in terms of how they should be using these systems and why these policies are in place, while allowing them to do what they do to have a reasonable user experience while using these IT resources.
What is interesting, though, is two overwhelming messages come out regularly in the security sort of commentary sphere. One of them is that user education is tremendously important. And the other message is user education doesn't work. So, you know, that seems to be the conundrum of security, isn't it? Is that in that the only real way that we can expect a reasonable level of security for a complex organization is to ensure staff are well educated. But that process itself is very difficult.
Well, I don't think we're ever going to reach a situation where there will be an ideal world in one way or another. I mean, you know, we do educate drivers, we have road rules. At the end of the day, we still do have accidents and we still do have bad drivers. So I don't necessarily think that information security should be significantly different from physical security in that sense. I mean, user education is extremely important, but by the same token, you can't ignore the fact that even the most educated user might have a bad day.
Yeah.
So you have to look at it from both sides. I mean, I'm strongly against the IT establishment trying to treat users as idiots or criminals and trying to put them into these tiny little suffocating boxes in the name of security. I don't think that is a sustainable solution in the long run, because it actually creates a situation where users are willing or are compelled to go and circumvent the protection measures that IT puts in place. So it's a very dangerous situation to create.
Well, I've seen that in my experience as well, is that users will go around company security policy to install that application that they want or do this or do that. You know, it seems the more locked down you make the environment, the more the user rebels. You effectively, you know, you can take a 21-year-old receptionist and turn them into an expert hacker, really, can't you?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I understand that there needs to be certain limitations on what a user could do on a system. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're using your company computer or whether you're at home. I mean, you shouldn't be surfing the web with admin privileges. In the same way, when you're working in a corporate setting, you shouldn't be typing a Word document while having admin setting or browsing the web with admin setting, because admin privileges are not necessary for these tasks. There definitely should be that attitude of using the minimal amount of privileges required to perform the task at hand and only use super user privileges when you actually have to do something that requires it. So in that sense, I think whether it's in a corporate environment or at home, there should be some limitations as to what privileges you run on when you do regular things.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that message is one that's ever quite got through, particularly in the consumer sphere. But that leads me to another question, which is, what sort of risky behaviors do you see users engaging in? What are they doing to put organizations at risk?
I think one of the biggest problems that you do come across is the user's ability to install software. I mean, I think this is something that comes up all the time. Users want to install software, and IT always says no. And there's two sides to this, because IT has a responsibility of maintaining secured and updated systems. So if a user goes and installs a piece of software that IT doesn't know about, and it requires updates at a future point to address particular security issues, IT might not know about it, and it might end up creating an insecure endpoint system.
And I suppose one of the other problems too is that software makers increasingly are making, you know, smaller sort of utilities that are popular with individuals. You don't actually need admin privileges always to install them, do you?
Yeah. Now that this brings us to the other issue. I mean, the central policy and security of the endpoint system then becomes important, because a lot of functionality is now available not just as local installed software, but as various web-delivered software. And increasingly, these systems are getting more and more access to local resources. Like, for example, if you look at things like Adobe Air, they're actually extending the browser by giving web-enabled applications more access to the local resources.
So it's sort of ActiveX all over again?
Yeah.
Great. It just seems like we never learn, do we?
I mean, I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing, in the sense that to be able to power the functionality that is being increasingly delivered over the network, we really do need to have greater access to local resources in order to be able to do it. One of the key factors here is that, in general, if in a properly configured, secured system, unless there is an undisclosed, unknown vulnerability that exists, the user privileges should never be able to be elevated. So if a local user is using, say, a certain application, whether it's web-delivered or not, to do something other than that is something that is completely related to their work, that application should not be able to have an impact on the sensitive corporate resources.
Well, it shouldn't. You're right. But I mean, it's a foothold, isn't it? Once you've got access to a user account on a workstation, you can then propagate your attack.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the reason why this is possible is because at the endpoints today, we don't have the degree of necessary isolation to make this happen.
Mm-hmm. So what needs to happen?
Well, I think what needs to happen is that ultimately, we are going to have to create the necessary infrastructure technology and the capability to create policies at the endpoint that will allow greater application isolation, whereby which the user could, within reasonable limits, of course, run untrusted applications for whatever their personal use or in terms of work or whatever it is, without actually these untrusted applications being able to interact with sensitive corporate resources.
It sort of sounds like that future virtualized desktop system that we're always hearing about, where you've got multiple CPU cores, you've got your work environment running on one core, you've got your fun applications running on another core. You know, is that sort of what you're talking about? And you can have an untrusted core where you can run your browser and your, you know, all of your risky software.
Well, that is certainly one. That would be certainly one way to implement it, yes. And the other side you can't forget is that also network access control. For example, an untrusted application should not be able to access network shares that are company resources. I mean, ordinarily, for example, a user might have privileges to the company's shared documents folder on some network share. But if the user is running an untrusted application, that untrusted application itself should not have access to that resource.
Nishad Harath, thank you very much for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business this week.
My pleasure. Na na na, na na na, wasted, wasted
again. Na na na, na na na, wasted. Nishad Harath there from McAfee with this week's sponsor interview. And that's it for this edition of Risky Business. I hope you've enjoyed it. This week's Sound Foundation track is Wasted by the Naked Apes. You can buy it from soundfoundation.com.au. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. She was a stutter, wasted. Wake up, she's an 18-tutter, wasted. I guess I'll do a runner again. It's all hazy now. I really can't remember how I ended up in bed with her. And I'm not wearing pants. One night of desperation. There goes my reputation. Nah, nah, nah. Na na na, wasted, wasted again. Na na na, na na na, wasted again. I can't remember my name, I'm as high as a kite, but I just had one drink. Someone must have laced it, she's here again. The girl from last night, was she really so large? Wasted, out of 10, she's a water. Wasted, she passed out, she'd be funner. Be with your mother again. It's all hazy now. I really can't remember how I ended up in bed with her. And I'm not wearing pants. One night of desperation. There goes my reputation. So I may as well do it again. Cause I know I'm gonna do it again. Again, 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 again. Yeah, I know I'm gonna do it again. Again, 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 again. I hope next time she brings a friend. Na na na, na na na, wasted, wasted again. Na na na, na na na, wasted again. So we got wasted, and a friend came over. Wasted, she said, hi, I'm Mona. Wasted, they want me to sleep. With Lisa and Mona, her friend. I may never get a threesome again. I can't get too wasted, or I won't do it with them. I can't get too wasted.